Well, it was the industrial planning branch. So it so happened that Thelma allowed to lecture these students. There were 20 of them. They were all officers, and they'd been through the Wright Field Technical Institute. And so everybody likes to take a brochure back when you go listen to something. So I had a fellow put together what at that time was an outline, in fact, of how an airplane was built.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, in the morning, it was a tour, because the schedule and everything's on here, was a tour, and then right after lunch, I guess I spent about 3 to 4 hours following this outline with questions and answers too. And then I gave each one of these, and I did that, I think, 3 different years or something like that. So I have here what we call the handbook for production program, and it takes a large cargo airplane and tells how to get started and what's important and how it finally gets built. Now, I could take an hour and run through this, or an hour and a half, whatever.
That'd be good. I think one of the things I was concerned about was, as we interview people, for us to understand clearly what the different functions and jobs were on different parts of the plane, so that we can ask much better questions and have an overall view of the construction of the plane, and also the extent to which the structure of the plans is defined by that process.
Now, okay, what I'd suggest that you break in and ask a question on anything. And this, the thing that, there's a preamble here which I went over yesterday, but the main thing is to state over here what it was, and then talk about what is called the 3 views of an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
That, and then it goes over into step by step how the airplane and what many people do. And then there's the famous what's called an exploded view, where we sit down and break up the airplane into chunks, and it's as if it were exploding here, and then all these pieces are accounted for, and they eventually all come together at stages, and an airplane evolves. Now, we can take this either right at the end of World War II. Is that the time frame?
Or during the war years.
Well, okay. Then during the war years, then it would be an airplane called a C-74. And one airplane was completed when the war ended, when a series of them were in line.
Mm-hmm.
And work was performed heavily right at the end of the war, and then after the end of the war, this is the only thing the Long Beach plant was producing.
Uh-huh.
So, well, I'd like to just cover some of the early information, how it all gets started, and what it's all about. And it would start with the basic objectives in the program and then take through. So why don't I just wander through this and start out with how it gets started, and then go on into the functions that are performed. And in most cases, women work on these functions, but you'll find that assembly is where most of them wound up.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, airplanes were about 20% of the direct manufacturing hours, which was the big part of business. About 20% was fabrication, that's the machinery that makes parts. And 80% of the assembly and sub-assembly and installation. Well, you take a factory that has 25,000, 30,000 people there, 80% of them would be assemblers. Now, this has changed today with the jet and so forth. They've added other factors, and more of the assembly operations now go back into fabrication. In other words, this table here, for instance, is assembled, is made up in these quadrants. Mm-hmm. You can see the cracks here. So these are separate pieces. Well, in World War II, before and right after, we would build this in segments like you see here. Now maybe it would pay nowadays to take a big chunk of metal, or wood in this case, and just carve out the whole circle at once. Well, now you've moved the fabrication, which made the little pieces and all the connections and so forth. And then it all went over to assembly, and a group of people put the legs on and put that thing in the center and then put these quadrants in here. And that was assembly. Well, now you're going to hog the whole thing out on a machine that now becomes fabrication. So where there was 80% labor putting all these pieces together, now it turns out there's only 40%. And 60% is in fabrication. Big machines are doing this. The machines got bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well, during those days, when you had such a high proportion in assembly, physically, was the fabrication done in separate buildings from the area of sub-assembly, say?
Well, it was at Douglas, in Douglas Long Beach. The Douglas Long Beach plant was the first plant in the West to be built without windows. It was completely air-conditioned and decentralized buildings. In other words, we had 18 different buildings, and there were two buildings set aside for fabrication. The machine shop, the machine metal and welding and all that stuff were in two buildings. And one building tended to be the machine shop, and the other building tended to be heavily sheet metal. So the buildings here were even specialized. And then you had what we call assembly buildings. And those assembly buildings were long and allowed you to put line and airplanes to be built. So we started out with, have you got the machine on? The basic objectives in a production program, because it's production that you're interested in, and it is what you call recurring. The engineer can come in and design an airplane. It can be planned and tooled and everything set up. That's all what we call non-recurring, one shot. It's all done. Then the repetition comes and continuing to build and build and build. So it's a production program that's the dominant thing. It's where all the costs are and so forth. In the basic objectives for the production program, we have the planning and putting into effect the airplane program, and the company then has to sit down, whatever company it might be, and they have to have objectives to follow. So it set the tone of the program. And in this particular case, the Douglas Company and the other companies would have these basic objectives: outstanding quality of product, maximum expandability of production output. In other words, you come in and double the rate of airplanes coming off the line or automobiles, whatever they might be. Early completion of an original article so people can see what the finished thing's going to be. The quicker you can get that done, the better it is for engineering and for the customer and for the shop. Then rapid attainment of schedule production rate, the ability to build up. And in time of war, if you want to go this way, your chances are you go this way and you ought to be going that way. Mm-hmm. What we're saying is that the ability to get the product out successfully, usable product, is pretty important. Now, of course, the fifth objective would be the minimum overall costs of all of this. And the slower you go up the schedule, the more it costs. So the longer it takes to get the first article out, in the meantime, you've built a lot of other assemblies and you're ready to back that up, and now you've got the final product and somebody doesn't like it. Well, you can avoid some of that by making what we call a mock-up. In other words, you make generally out of metal and wood a fuselage and one wing, let's say, and you try to make that look like the regular airplane, and people go through and say, yeah, that's all right, and so forth and so on. But the main thing is to get that first article out. Now, in a balanced manufacturing program, the basic program must be integrated. Nowadays, we called it integration then, but nowadays they have people who are called integrators, system integrators. They go around and see that the hydraulics man doesn't put his tubing where the electrical man planned to put his wires, and where the control man hoped to put his cables. Mm-hmm. You can see how you can fight for very limited space, and who gets there first is an important thing. So the integration has to take place. Now it's especially then, we just spoke of it, as it's obvious. So starting in engineering and the planning departments, coming out with a design approach, and then extending the integration through all the phases of manufacturing, scheduling, layouts, tooling, mock-up, models, equipment, the fabrication and assembly, the installation. And each of these functions must be coordinated in a balanced manufacturing plan, aimed at creating the end product within the framework of the basic objectives which control the particular work at hand. Well, those are fancy words, but it is necessary that you start out with statements like this so everybody gets a feel of what's to be done. It's not that you're just, well, we're going to build another airplane, fellas. Let's have at it. So, you have to really, in a sense, put out a philosophy of what you're attempting to do and why it's important. Now, the five objectives that I spoke about are the primary objectives controlling an airplane such as the C-74 that was built at Long Beach during World War II. That was the largest cargo airplane and the largest airplane built at that time, except for the B-19, which was bigger, but it was a bomber. From the objectives set up, we believe it to be a balanced manufacturing program, and we bring to bear all factors which affect the production program, each in its proper weight and perspective. Now, this is where somebody has to give guidance and interpret the philosophy and the objectives and not overemphasize sweeping the floor when driving rivets is more important. And the Douglas Company, in this case, of course, has been fortunate. They built cargo airplanes and large airplanes, small airplanes, commercial, fighter, and so on, so forth. To get started, of course, you need, somebody has to come up with a suggestion of what's needed. And this can be a customer like Wright Field in the case of a cargo airplane, or it might be an airline. They establish a need. They begin talking about we've got to have a better airplane to perform these missions. Or the company sees a hole in the planning by the Department of Defense or mm-hmm. the airline, and they come in and say, hey fellas, why don't you do this? And so the company then spends their own money in many cases, and they develop a program, and they build a mock-up, and they have models and sketches and everything to interest the customer. So then they would go back to the headquarters of the customer, wherever it happened to be, and they'd sit down and say, we think there is a place for this kind of an airplane. And so they sit down, talk it over, and the customer then would turn around and give a study contract. They want more information. So the company's proposal is given to the customer, and the customer's approval for preliminary work, which would come out in a letter of intent. And this letter of intent would allow you to spend money and so forth up to a point. Now, let's say the 10th airplane or the 20th airplane, the letter of intent has to turn into a contract. Mm. Now, you agree that by the 10th airplane, you will sit down and plan the cost of the airplane. There's always a danger the customer says, well, it's going to cost more than we can afford. So it gets scrapped at that point. And this happens quite often. In these proposal stages, one of the first things that the engineers do is to come up with what's known as a 3D drawing. A 3D drawing shows the airplane looking down from the top, looking in from the side, and looking head on, and then it has a series of dimensions and notes which become a master takeoff point. They control the overall airplane, and in it they're guaranteeing performance, how fast it will go, and how high it will go, and how much weight it will carry, and so forth. Now, if the company and the customer agree, they get a contract together to produce the airplane. And the preparation release of the general coverage of launching an airplane, some way management has to get all these facilities started. So they put out what's known as a work release order. Now, other people would call it by a different name, but what it says is that we have a contract, this is what we want you to do. So we put out a work release order that has a broad cut of what should be done, and it then is the start of the program, and it will have limitations in it, and it will be followed up by thousands of other WROs, work release orders, because as soon as you start working on the program, changes are introduced, errors are found. So you have to, in order to tell the people who do this work what to do, you have to put out another work release order and say, change it. And shortly after the release of the work release order, Sperry's provisioning takes place. In other words, right away, along with the regular program, you got to sit down and decide how many spare wings you want, and cowling, and landing gear, and wheels, and seats, and instruments, and so forth. And it's a best guess based on the past. You might provision a set of wings and have three times as many wings as they ever use. Now, the reason you use wings because every now and then they run into something with the wing and it bangs it up and I'd seen were a propeller of another aircraft, just a fellow just moving about 1 mile an hour up, and the propeller just chopped up the wing of another airplane. Well, you need a spare wing right away, because that airplane's out of commission. So they call it spare and provision. And you build spares right along with building the airplane, so that when the airplane goes, starts to fly, you've got some backup to keep the airplane in the air. The greater part of the overall scheduling must be covered in the early stages of the program. You just got to know when things should be done. The schedule allotment chart, which more or less apportions the time requirements of the various functions such as engineering, material, manufacturing, quality, and so forth. So there's a chart made out that is called a Gantt chart. It's just a bar chart. And it brings in the major functions and saying what to do and by when. Then there's an assembly flow chart made, which is a further breakdown, which I'll add to later. And a great deal of negotiating between various groups within the company takes place, so that some fellow doesn't get more than his share of time to accomplish what he's supposed to do. Now, completion of the assembly flow charts affords an early estimate of the machine and personnel loads in fabrication, assembly, and installation departments. It tells you when you need the people and what machines to order and have them in by when. If you need the machine to make this big table here, it better be in time to make the table. And one of the failures in World War II was spares were not provisioned along with the float on the airplane. And equipment that was sorely needed was not put on order until too late, because no one got to the facilities people to order the equipment. And then down the 1212 American Avenue in Long Beach, in this case, a hiring program goes down there. Those people down there are paid to hire people, and you have said in your schedule that you need so many people at various positions of this airplane, and start hiring. Yeah. Well, they start hiring, but you may not have the parts or the tooling or the engineering to go ahead. So you find that they're down there hiring, and the people come in, and people get exasperated and don't know what to do with them, and so they wander around and they get upset because there's nothing to do. So you hopefully call the hiring office downtown Long Beach and say, hey, no more people until we can use the ones you got, and then you have the problem of stacking them up again when you need them, because then you need them in a rush. Everything showed up late, and you need all kinds of people. And then the personnel department, they begin to argue that, well, we can't meet it, and the airplane then goes behind schedule, which tends to get a little disastrous. Now, receipt of the general coverage work release order and the detailed work release orders that authorize engineering to design from preliminary layouts and design data. The structures and the details also have to be designed. And this is authorized again by the WRO. Part of this work is being done during the time schedules and flowcharts are being completed by other people. Designs for such schedules indicate limited time allowance required for advanced material orders. There's certain material that's critical, and you got to put it on order right away. So as soon as you get the notification, you go ahead. You're sitting there knowing that certain types of material must be ordered at the go-ahead because it's so hard to get it. It may, and in wartime, such as we're talking about here, the materials would be allocated. Mm-hmm. Engines would be allocated. Mm-hmm. Propellers would be allocated. So you better get the orders in right now. the advanced material orders are then forwarded to the planning department, and they put out a form that authorizes the purchasing. Design vellums are completed and sent to check and blueprint and so forth, and the engineering release group then gets the design material, and they begin to release it. And the only trouble is with that, it piles up in what they call the check system and the stress group. There's a group of engineers and they finally go after it and recalculate everything the designer calculated to see if it worked. And that can be a bottleneck, as well as check print. There are people to check that you haven't got contradictory dimensions that you're working to. So the first problems that arise are in engineering where the work piles up because of delays that were not anticipated. Or risks were taken will allow you so many weeks to get this out. And then when you get it out, you appeal to the customer and say, well, we're 3 months late. For instance, now the DC-9 Super 80 that's being built at Douglas Long Beach is about 4 months behind schedule for the reasons we're talking about. Now there are customers that will get that 4 months late. Well, that customer has had to advertise the use of that airplane, and he expects it to be out in January and doesn't come out until April. He's got to rearrange all his thinking. And in the military, like we're talking about here, these airplanes may be scheduled, for instance, to go to the old Berlin Airlift, which is very typical. And if you don't get them there, they've got stuff piled up all over, waiting to be hauled away, and they've got people that they sent over to Europe based on when this airplane would be out. And those people just sit there because the airplanes are late. And this is true of anything else, guns, tanks, so forth. Now the first people that get at the engineering drawing are the assembly planners. They break down the assemblies that are called for on the production drawings, and they prepare assembly outlines. And these are labeled AOs. And they put out the required tooling orders for assembly. These would be the large jigs and fixtures and installation tooling. The fabrication planners prepare fabrication orders to run things through the sheet metal shop and the weld shop and machine shop. And the fabrication planners make out their fabrication orders based on what the assembly people have asked for. Now this gets to be quite involved at this point because the engineers draw the wing up and all its components. But that's not the way the shop builds the airplane. The shop then puts an economic factor into it that the engineer didn't have time to do in many cases. And they begin rearranging the sub-assemblies and assemblies and so forth. And they call for parts to be fabricated, and the engineering drawing shows the holes in the part. Mm-hmm. It might be a casting with four bolts on to fasten it down. Well, the assembly planner will say he doesn't want those holes in there, or he doesn't want them full size, so they'd be drilled on assembly. And so the engineer, if he made it to the engineer's drawing, it wouldn't fit the assembly plan that the production people have come up with, manufacturing engineers. So the fabrication guy, when he plans to make that bracket, he notes that the assembly planner said, put the holes in undersized. And this is frequently done, and particularly early in the program. Now later, at the 20th airplane, the planner comes back and puts the holes in full size because the tooling was accurate enough to coordinate that bracket to the other part. But he allows just, he puts a pilot hole in there so that they can stick it up there, and if it doesn't quite line up, they can move the hole over. Mm-hmm. Or they, it's a convenience to drill right through, and the part it's attaching to, there's no problem of accuracy of the misalignment. So this is a terrific part of the business. There's a good assembly planner. He's planning how the fuselage and the wing and tail service and all these things be put together. And the fabrication planner, he just follows the assembly outline planner and does it to the best of his ability. There is a tendency in the early airplanes to leave a lot of parts blank because you're not so sure that the